When Jesus says that he is the way, the truth, and the life, does he mean the only way, truth, and life? I answer that question in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In our Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Christopher Neuendorf writes about his journey into Lutheranism from Greek Orthodoxy. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org. Russian leader Vladimir Putin has asserted many times in the last month that the country, Ukraine, is not really truly a country. It's a made-up country, he said in one context. Is that true? And other than those claims, what have the demographics of both Ukraine and Russia done to bring them to war, and what will it look like after the war? Birth rate, immigration, and now 4 million refugees and counting. Will it also change the demographics of Europe as well? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about demographics and the Russia-Ukraine war, Lyman Stone. He's a PhD candidate in population dynamics at McGill University, director of research for demographic intelligence, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, research fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, and author of a recent study titled The Demography of War, Ukraine versus Russia. Lyman, welcome back.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you all.
You say that demography is a core part of war. What do you mean by that?
Demography has a lot of different connections to war. But I mean, at the simplest level, wars are conflicts between nations, which are often conflicts between peoples. And so the relevant populations involved are essential to the determinant of what a war will be about, the progress of the war, how it will be fought, the end result, and most of the processes of war we can think of in kind of demographic terms.
How have arguments about population and demography been used by both sides in the lead up to the Russian-Ukraine war?
Many different ways. So both Russia and Ukraine have declining populations, which has been definitely a source of some anxiety on the part of both governments and led to different reactions in the different places. Russia has reacted by trying to expand to reclaim more Russian-speaking minorities, and they've tried to encourage fertility as a way to sort of shore up their population. Ukraine has not been... There aren't really a lot of other Ukrainian minorities for them to incorporate. They don't really have money for pronatalism, so they've responded to declining fertility really by intensifying the level of nationalism within Ukraine. But beyond that, there's kind of an underlying population genetic question that I didn't get into in the article I published on this, but the Russian government tends to say that Ukrainians are not a real ethnicity, that they're just Russians. They're not really a different group. This turns out to be false. In large-scale genetic analyses, it turns out that Ukrainians are a pretty distinct genetic cluster, whereas Russians are actually kind of all over the map. There's not really a clear single genetic signature for Russian identity. So in fact, Ukraine has a pretty clear, so to speak, I don't want to say like a biological nationality, but there is a genetic signature there, whereas Russians are kind of an amalgam of lots of different peoples that over time have just kind of had the label Russian slapped on them.
Does that mean that Vladimir Putin's picture that he painted very vividly before the invasion in his long essay / speech about reclaiming essentially a Russian people by doing this is basically baseless?
Yes, it's complete nonsense. So, I mean, it's nonsense on the population genetic level. It's nonsense on a linguistic level. Yes, Ukrainian is linguistically related to Russian. It's somewhere between, 50 and 70% intelligible with Russian, which is, it's not nothing, but that's not that much higher than some of the Romance languages are with each other. We wouldn't say that like Spanish and Portuguese are actually the same language. Historically, these areas, it's not like Ukraine has always been part of Russia or something. Parts of it were part of Poland, parts of it were part of Russia, parts of it were part of the Ottoman Empire at various times. Right now I'm reading a novel called Taras Bulba by the Russian author Nikolai Gogol. And it's about a Ukrainian Cossack, right? And this people group, Cossacks in Ukraine, who they get described as Russian, but they're kind of not. They're really their own unusual militarized people group who developed in these borderlands between the Russian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And so really Ukrainian identity, I mean, it does have a distinct history and culture that is related to Russia, but it's not like this is a fake nation. I mean, the Russian czars were so worried about Ukrainian nationalism that under Tsarist Russia, it was illegal to teach in Ukrainian. They tried to exterminate the language, which if you're trying to exterminate the language, maybe that tells you that there is a real difference. So they also settled lots of Russians into the region. So this story that Russia tells that Ukraine's not a real country, that it's just like, you know, knockoff Russians or whatever, is false. It has been false for hundreds of years of Russian imperialists trying to tell this story. But it's important that people understand that this story is completely false. It's false on every possible level. And it is a fabrication invented purely to justify Russian imperialism.
So Putin's not the first one pull this.
And I mean, you know, even a lot of Putin's defenders within Russia, you know, I follow some of these like Russian irredentist types on Twitter, and they'll refer to Putin's ideology positively as white guardist. That's a reference to the Russian Civil War, the anti-Soviet faction. But what they mean is sort of a renewal of the sort of czarist imperialist idea for Russia.
Tell us how birth rates are important in understanding war.
So war is generally a young man's game. Typically, most of your combatants are not elders, and they are disproportionately men. As a result, how many births are occurring in your society is pretty important for how many potential soldiers you have, and also for your potential economic base and all these kinds of things. Both Russia and Ukraine have had low birth rates for quite a while. But Ukraine's are lower. They've fallen lower. And as a result, Ukraine's population has fallen faster. Ukraine also has had higher rates of emigration out and lower rates of immigration in for a variety of reasons. And the result is that Ukraine's population has been declining a lot faster than Russia's over the last 30 years. And as a result, Ukraine's relative position with regards to Russia in terms of like how many men can they field for a battle versus how many can Russia theoretically field, right, has been in persistent decline, just in terms of like raw numbers of fighting age men. So birth rates are really important for this. They've resulted in Ukraine having a constantly deteriorating position. And that deterioration is motivating the strategies of both sides. Russia would like to let Ukraine keep slowly deteriorating and, you know, gradually peel off bits and pieces of Ukraine, or just not peel anything off and gradually have it become so small and so weak that it kind of becomes a rump state that Russia can be the puppeteer for, like Belarus to the north. So that's what Russia would like to see, is that continuing decline, with Russia intensifying its influence over Ukraine and its territory. Ukrainians also see the decline, and they respond to it by recognizing that that means their position is not likely to improve in the future. So they really have to take action now to secure the future of their nation. And also they have to find strategies that can break them out of this kind of demographic feedback loop. And so that gets to the rise in Ukrainian nationalism as opposed to Russian imperialism.
What role has immigration played?
So Russia receives a lot of immigrants. It is one of the largest immigrant receiving countries in the world. And a very large share of Russia's soldiers are ethnic minorities. That is both long-term ethnic minorities, but also immigrants and the children of immigrants. Long-term ethnic Russians are not nearly as big a share of the Russian army as they are of Russia's population. And Russia is really highly dependent on immigration. They are a large, we could say, cosmopolitan empire with lots of different ethnic groups within their borders and within their former borders, the former borders of Tsarist Russia or the Soviet Union. And those people coming from poorer countries often move to Russia to work. And this gives Russia really kind of a constant flow of young blood, so to speak, which helps boost their population. Ukraine does not have that sort of large former empire. And as a result, they don't receive as much immigration. And moreover, Ukraine in recent years has had improving visa access to Europe. And as a result, more and more Ukrainians have been moving to Europe, especially to Poland. So as a result of this, Ukraine has had considerably more negative net migration than Russia has had in recent decades. And so this exacerbates the problem, as migrants tend to be young people, young men. And so this makes Ukraine's problem even worse.
Lyman Stone is our guest. We're talking about demographics and the Russia-Ukraine war. On the other side, it sounds like the two countries, even apart from the war itself, were on a demographic collision course, and Ukraine was probably going to lose. We'll be right back. When Jesus says that he is the way, the truth, and the life, does he mean the only way, truth, and life? I answer that question in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In our Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Christopher Neuendorf writes about his journey into Lutheranism from Greek Orthodoxy. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
They've met with the pastor week after week. He's taught them our precepts and Christ Jesus to seek. He shared the law of our God, which we strive to keep, the prayers, the creeds, and the sacraments deep. Now these young saints are right to partake in Christ's body and blood, all for his sake. A gift you are seeking to commemorate this? Ad Crucem has just what you won't want to miss. We've got icons, art, ornaments, jewelry, and more, greeting cards, crucifixes, posters, gifts galore. Your catechized friend will love what you give and treasure the gift all the days that they live.
Lutheranism in the Public Square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Sioux Falls, South Dakota has big city anemones with small town feel, civil freedom, and the natural beauty of its namesake waterfalls. It is also home to Christ Lutheran Church, where the living water, Christ himself, flows. Located near I-90 and I-229, Christ Lutheran offers divine service with Holy Communion each Sunday at 9:30 a.m. Learn more about this confessional liturgical parish at ChristSiouxFalls.org. Christ Lutheran Church, building upon Christ.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Lyman Stone, Director of Research for Demographic Intelligence, about demographics and the Russia-Ukraine war. So based on what you said before the break, Lyman, it sounds like apart from the war that has broken out between the two countries, these two countries were on a demographic collision course and Ukraine was going to lose.
Yes. Fundamentally, Russia has an abiding centuries-long interest in controlling the territory occupied by Ukraine. And Ukraine has a fundamental interest, reaching back centuries, in keeping their frontier as far east of the Dnieper River as they possibly can. This is just, for a variety of reasons, this has been the interests of states in these areas for as long as they have existed. And that's not going to change. And as a result, because Ukraine's position was deteriorating and Russia's was too, but not as fast, Russia's situation was getting better and better relative to Ukraine up until, well, it depends on how you count it, but either 2005 or maybe 2014, 15. And so, yeah, this was a collision course, particularly because Ukraine responded to its deteriorating position by not accepting defeat and by doubling down essentially on nationalism as a strategy to counter Russia's larger absolute power.
So how does Russia hold an advantage in terms of potential soldiers they can field?
Russia has a fighting age male population of about three times that of Ukraine. And the ratio became even more lopsided after 2014 when Russia seized Crimea and then has the breakaway regions in the east that they effectively control. So as a result, Russia has a huge advantage in manpower in absolute terms.
Why is population then a relevant measure in understanding this war in a larger sense?
Population is relevant because it sets the stage for the major players and it establishes the power imbalance that exists and it motivates their strategy, right? Russia would prefer to wait and let Ukraine continue to decline, but if need be, they are very large and powerful and feel they can win in a war. Ukraine would prefer not to decline further, so they have incentives to not avoid conflict now when their position is better than it will be in the future. And in particular, they need to mobilize a huge share of their society in order to have a fighting chance. And so population sets the stage. It sort of defines the strategies each side can use. And so it's relevant, but ultimately there's more than just population counts that really matter.
I guess it raises the question, the conventional wisdom, depending on who you listen to today, is that Russia is losing this war. It is ill-equipped and ill-manned to do this, that this is the best they got. And in essence, the narrative is the scrappy little Ukrainian army is going to eventually defeat this Russian army. And there's nothing Putin can do anything about it. It's a nice way to think. Is it true?
You know, war is... There's always a degree of uncertainty and unpredictability, so I don't want to venture too bold a prognostication. But what I will say is that Ukraine really did pursue two very specific strategies. Seeing their weaker position, you can sort of see two political movements in Ukraine. There's a liberal movement and a nationalist movement. The liberal movement basically said, what we need is allies. Right. So they kind of went around to the EU and NATO and they said, look, Ukraine, we're a democracy. We have all these nice, good values that the Western world shares. So how about you be our allies? Give us weapons, give us training, give us all this stuff. And so that worked. Ukraine, they didn't join NATO, but they got lots of weapons and training and partnerships and stuff that has really helped them be able to ensure that they have a fighting chance. The nationalist tangent of this, and I should say it's really important here. I mean, Ukraine's government, when they kicked out the Russian puppets in 2014, like the first thing they did was impose a Ukrainian language education all around the country, right? Nationalism is a huge part of Ukraine's politics, which is why Putin is always talking about denazification and opposing nationalism, right? Because he sees that Ukraine is very nationalistic. And the nationalists, they basically, whereas the liberals were trying to acquire allies for Ukraine, the nationalists basically said, you know, in the meantime, we got to work with what we've got, and we have to find a way to motivate Ukrainians to fight, even if it's a losing battle. And so in the first war in 2014 and 15, Ukraine's regular army did not fare very well. They were really pushed back very quickly by the Russians. But these informal nationalist militias, including neo-Nazi groups like the Azov Battalion, they held their ground shockingly well. And so they both earned the hatred of the Russians and they earned the respect of a lot of Ukrainians. And the Ukrainian government has really fed into this nationalism. And as a result, what Ukraine has today is a population really fired by nationalist sentiment, by the idea that Ukraine is valuable and special and important and needs to persist at great cost. And also, they have a relatively, you know, small L liberal government that has succeeded in getting them guns, money, rockets, ammo, all the stuff you need to fight a war. And so you kind of have a 1-2 punch that Ukraine adopted of liberal nationalism, as it's called. And it's been very successful for them. And it means that they're doing quite well. Now, will they win? Oh, well, on some level, some versions of victory are already impossible, right? They will already have lost, you know, thousands dead around the country, millions have fled, entire cities that it's hard to imagine them ever being rebuilt as they were before. There's some versions of victory that are already beyond reach. But is it possible they could reclaim all the territory they had at the beginning of this war? Yes. Is it possible they might even reclaim some of the territories that they had lost in 2014 and 2015? Maybe. Is it a sure thing? Certainly not.
We're talking with Lyman Stone, a PhD candidate in population dynamics at McGill University and director of research for demographic intelligence, about demographics and the Russia-Ukraine war. When we come back with him, why and how is Ukraine's position ending? Eternal Anthems, the story behind your favorite hymns, is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's like a short biography for about 50 of your favorite hymns. You can find it at our website, issuesetc.org. Look for Eternal Anthems there on every page of the website, or just give Concordia Publishing House a call and order Eternal Anthems, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. More with Lyman Stone on the demographics of the Russia-Ukraine war after this.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the demographics of the Russia-Ukraine war with Lyman Stone. In about a half hour, we'll discuss a verdict in the trial of Finnish Lutheran leaders for statements on human sexuality with Lorcan Price of Alliance Defending Freedom International. Lyman, how and why is Ukraine's demographic position eroding?
Over time, it's eroded, as I said, because of falling fertility and deteriorating immigration. There's also life expectancy is fairly low in Ukraine and Russia compared to other industrialized countries. This results in a really negative position. That said, there is more to it than that. That particularly over the course of the 2000s, we have these regular surveys that ask people how willing they would be to fight for their country. And in Ukraine, that number declined persistently during the 2000s. And it really hit a low ebb in 2011 when, like, in eastern Ukraine and in Crimea, like, less than half of fighting age men said they were willing to fight for Ukraine. But since then, it has gone way up. So that decline in sort of patriotic willingness to fight over the 2000s really led to Ukraine's position being even worse than it looked from the core demographics. But then since then, the rise of basically nationalism in Ukraine has caused that number to jump way back up. So that in 2020, the last survey we had, Ukrainians had very high reported willingness to fight.
We hear a lot about Putin's miscalculation, but what role did those surveys play in Russia's miscalculation regarding Ukrainian willingness to resist?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite bits in this whole issue. There's this nice report that came out where basically the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB, which is the successor to the NKVD, so Russia's intelligence agency, you know, they conduct foreign intelligence, and as part of it, you know, they run surveys. So they ran a survey in Ukraine, and they found that only 60% of Ukrainians were willing to fight for Ukraine. They said, gosh, that means public support for the country must be very low. And this is like, this is why, you know, you really need good social science in your intelligence agency, because they looked at that and they thought that meant Ukraine would be easy to take. The reason they thought that is in 2011, surveys in Crimea showed a similar level of Crimea and in the Donbass showed similar levels of opposition to willingness to fight. That is to say, they kind of walked into Crimea without a fight. Taking the Donbass was not hard. And so they thought, well, gosh, if all of Ukraine has that kind of survey characteristic now, Ukrainians aren't going to fight. It's going to be an easy takeover. We're just going to walk in and occupy the place. This will be a cakewalk. The problem is they included in the denominator for that survey women and old people and lots of people who said, no, I don't expect to fight because, you know, I'm 82. We have this survey in 2020. It's not the same one that the Russians ran. It is at the same time, and it yields the same summary statistics. So it's probably a similar representation. We can see in 2020 that, yeah, only 60% of Ukrainians said they were willing to fight for Ukraine in 2020. But among fighting age men, it was like 83% or something like that, which is above the global average, right? So Russia basically ran this survey, didn't really run the detailed cross tabulations on it. And this was apparently, I mean, according to, I guess, you know, people whose job it is to understand Russian intelligence, this is apparently a big part of their planning going into the war. And you can see that, right? They dropped these paratroopers right into the Hostomel airport, thinking that they wouldn't get much resistance. They sent their National Guard units ahead of their main military early in the war because they just didn't expect resistance. Because they did this survey and it was wrong and it was predictably wrong. You would know this if you had looked at, you know, credible international surveys of things like patriotism and willingness to fight. And particularly, there was always this story going around like, oh, Eastern Ukraine is all Russian speaking, so they're probably disloyal to Ukraine. The thing is, on this willingness to fight measure, there was no significant difference between people in Eastern and Western Ukraine. People in Eastern and Western Ukraine in 2020 had exactly the same willingness to fight for Ukraine. So this idea that, yeah, Ukraine has a linguistic division, but it's not a division of identification with the country of Ukraine. Even the Russian speakers don't want to be part of Russia.
There have been some connections made to religious demographics, and maybe even only in the kind of the face of Putin himself, but are there religious demographics at work in this conflict?
Yeah, the religious situation in Ukraine and Russia is really, really complicated. So Ukrainians on average are more religious than Russians, people in Ukraine versus people in Russia. And the most secular parts of Ukraine before 2014 were Crimea and the Donbass, the Eastern rebel regions. So the parts of Ukraine that broke away and joined Russia were the most secular parts. The most nationalistic parts of Ukraine are Western Ukraine, which are also the most religious parts. Out in Western Ukraine, you have both Orthodox, but also you have a lot of Ukrainian Catholic. Among the, I believe, the Orthodox majority of Ukrainians, historically, they were sort of the Ukraine, I forget the term, but basically you can think of it as like the Ukraine diocese of the Russian Orthodox Church, essentially. That's basically how you can think of it. But a few years ago, the Ecumenical Patriarch of Eastern Orthodoxy, so kind of the highest authority there, recognized a breakaway group in Ukraine and said, no, Ukraine can have their own independent branch of Eastern Orthodoxy. This is a big deal. So he like recognized this. And this caused a schism. Now, most Ukrainians stayed with the Russian church, but that was partly just because they kind of had the resources and all this stuff, and the government didn't get as involved as they might have. But nowadays, now during this war, we're seeing evidence that probably that shift is going to intensify. So I just watched a video earlier today. There's this priest in one of these Ukrainian Orthodox churches that's aligned with Moscow, and he was doing prayers, and he refused to pray for Ukrainian casualties of war. And instead, he prayed for Vladimir Putin. He offered prayers for him. And in the middle of the service, the parishioners got up and started beating the priest and then hauled him out and threw him on the street. Now, I'm not applauding that. I wouldn't say you should beat up your pastor for political disagreements. At the same time, we are seeing a change in Ukrainian Orthodoxy right now. And that's important because the Russian Orthodox Church is, to a considerable extent, at this point, a branch of the Russian government. I mean, the Russian military built this gigantic new cathedral in Moscow, paid for with military budget. It's called the Church of the Armed Forces. It's really wild to look up pictures of it. Many of the wealthy billionaires very close to Putin spend a lot of money promoting Orthodoxy, ensuring that the priests within Orthodoxy and especially the high-ranking ones are loyal to Moscow politically, and also ensuring that churches abroad don't do anything hostile to Russia's interests. So, for example, the country that has received the most Ukrainian refugees per capita is Moldova. It's also a very poor country. It's not part of NATO. They're really out on a limb here. A large part of Moldova is being occupied by Russian troops and has been for about 30 years. But although there's all these refugees and many churches are doing a lot to help, the Moldovan Orthodox Church, which is the largest church body in Moldova, is refusing to provide any assistance to refugees. Why? Because the leaders of the Moldovan Orthodox Church are closely aligned with the leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church. Why? Because a handful of Russian billionaires spend a lot of money to ensure that Russian Orthodox leaders around the world are in close alignment with the political priorities of Moscow. So yeah, there's a huge religious element to all of this. One of the unfortunate stereotypes is that Russia has really promoted this idea that Ukraine is like these, you know, liberal Westerners and Russia is like traditional conservatism. The reality is Russia is a more secular, multi-ethnic, cosmopolitan empire trying to crush a more religious, nationalistic country. It's totally the opposite of the story that Putin tells, right? Ukraine is a place that I think has a lot more in common with American conservatives than Russia in particular. Now, I'm biased in that because I worked in Ukraine for a little while, but so I have a bias there.
The nationalism, the Ukrainian nationalism, does it have a religious tenor or element to it?
That's a good question. I don't totally know. Russian nationalism definitely does. The famous mantra of the Tsarists was orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality. The idea that basically society should be built around an autocratic central government which promotes Russian nationality and Russian orthodoxy. So Russification around the empire. That's kind of Russian nationalism. Ukrainian nationalism, I don't know if it has as much of a religious element. There are definitely, you know, there's nationalism at work within religion in Ukraine. I mean, Ukrainian Catholicism kind of has its own thing. I think they're actually Eastern Rite Catholics, technically. And then the breakaway of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, the attempted breakaway, is definitely a rise of a kind of a religious nationalism. You know, there are several Lutheran church bodies in Ukraine that are in mission partnership with either the LCMS or the Lutheran Church Canada. They have complicated relationships among themselves, and they kind of all connect to different historic national communities in Ukraine. But my perception is that most current Ukrainian nationalism is really driven by language and a desire for democracy, and to some extent, sort of romanticized ethnic history or national history, but it's largely about language and democracy.
So you have mentioned some pivotal years, 2014-15, and you'd also mentioned the annexation of Crimea. What changed in Ukraine between roughly 2014 and today?
Yeah, so after, I've got to back up a little further. So after the Soviet Union broke apart, right, in like 1991, Ukraine becomes an independent, or maybe it was already independent, but they become, you know, fully de facto independent, right, their own country. But realistically, sort of Soviet officials basically stayed in control. It's not until I think it's 2006, there's what's called the Orange Revolution, where essentially sort of anti-Soviet, anti-communist leaders came to power in Ukraine. More pro-Western, you know, they wanted economic development, they wanted democracy, they wanted ties to Europe. They came to power. And the response was that Russian intelligence immediately tried to kill those leaders by poisoning them. And they were somewhat successful in some cases. So by, I believe, 2010 or 2011, this anti-Russian group had sort of been pushed back out of power, and a new pro-Russian government had come into power. The pro-Russian government encouraged Russian language education, protected Russian minorities, extended Russia's lease on a naval base in the Crimea. You know, they did all this pro-Russian stuff that actually started to irritate a lot of Ukrainians. They said, okay, look, like those, you know, those kind of pro-Western liberals that we put into power earlier, they might have gone a little too far. But now these like pro-Russian guys, like they're just turning our country into a puppet. And so there's tons of political dissatisfaction with these pro-Russian people. Ultimately, there were street protests when the pro-Russian government pulled out of a deal for association with the European Union. And then to disperse those protests, the government, this was in 2013, then 2014, the government sent in troops to open fire on the protesters. There were weeks, or I think maybe even months, of basically street conflict between the security forces of Ukraine and the protesters. And ultimately, the protesters won. The pro-Russian leader fled the country. The protesters took over the government. They undid the Russian language law. They, you know, instituted elections, all these, you know, things. And then they elected a new government. Russia was not too happy about this. And so Russian troops took over Crimea, which is a peninsula into the Black Sea in southern Ukraine. It's a peninsula that historically was mostly inhabited by Turkic-speaking Muslims, but Russia deported all of those people, in like the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and replaced them with ethnic Russians. So Crimea was very pro-Russia. And then also there were these regions in eastern Ukraine that are very pro-Russia that started a civil war. The democratic government in Ukraine got close to winning the civil war in the east. They were beating the rebels. And then Russia said, nah, we don't want you to beat the rebels. And they sent their troops into these regions to push the Ukrainian army back out. And then it became a stalemate. So in 2014 and 2015, over the course of these conflicts, Russia seized Crimea, which was one of the most prosperous and most strategically important parts of Ukraine. And they also started supporting these rebel groups in the east. Altogether, these areas accounted for a large share of Ukraine's total population. I mean, I think something like 15% or maybe 20% of Ukraine's population was lost to Russia. So that happened. Ukraine lost that first war pretty badly. And they would have lost it even more if it weren't for basically these nationalist militias that kind of just refused to ever retreat. And so after that, Ukraine really had a shakeup. They realized they needed to modernize their military, get better training, prepare for asymmetrical warfare, integrate these militias into the command structure, and find more allies. And so that's what they've been doing from 2014 until today.
Demographer Lyman Stone is our guest. Demographics and the Russia-Ukraine War is our topic. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're connected to Issues Etc. Folks, spring is the time when many of the church's young people publicly profess the faith in the rite of confirmation. Ad Crucem has confirmation greeting cards, certificates, gift boxes, and more. Find out more at adcrucem.com, adcrucem.com. When we return, what was happening in Russia during the same period of time? Have you ever wondered why our beloved hymns were written? What influenced the writers to craft these words that proclaim the gospel? Learn more about the words you love to sing in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, Eternal Anthems, The Story Behind Your Favorite Hymns. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Eternal Anthems, The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, 1-800-325-3040.
I'm Chaplain Sean Denzer, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Congregations work hard to keep the Word of Christ dwelling richly in His disciples now and into eternal life. We work to help and support that effort. Learn more at lcms.org/worship. You'll find resources on the church year, Bible studies on the hymns of the day, audio helps for learning to sing our services, and look for worship planning resources to find the latest from LCMS worship. That's lcms.org/worship. May the Word of Christ dwell richly in you.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
America's tradition of liberty depends on having colleges and universities that equip young people for the responsibilities of freedom. At Concordia University Chicago, freedom is a pillar of our education. We prepare our students to live as free, self-governing citizens. I'm Dr. Rachel Ferguson, Director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia Chicago. I invite you to visit us. Discover what it means for freedom to become a pillar of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Confessional Lutherans are invited to rent a 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom Table Rock lakefront home in the Ozarks. Table Rock Lake is a premier lake in the heart of the Ozarks for boating, water sports, and fishing. This log cabin-style rental sleeps 12 and is 30 minutes from Branson and 20 minutes from Silver Dollar City. Learn more by calling Swanson Estates, 713-855-2681. Be sure to mention Issues Etc., 713-855-2681.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about demographics and the Russia-Ukraine war with Lyman Stone. Lyman, before the break, we were talking about what happened in Ukraine from about 2014 on. What was happening in Russia during the same time?
Yeah, so in the late 90s and early 2000s, Putin comes to power in Russia, and he comes to power essentially as someone to prevent the return of kind of the communist government. He's kind of put in power to ensure that all the privatization of assets that led to all these Russian billionaires, the billionaires basically put Putin in power to ensure that the government doesn't take back all these valuable assets that these billionaires now control. So he's kind of, at first, he's kind of a stooge for these billionaires to protect themselves. But it turns out he's his own man, and he gains immense popularity by fighting a brutal but effective war to crush an insurgency in Chechnya, an Islamic region in southern Russia. He also, in the process, engages in some, he has Russia's intelligence services stage some bombings of Russian apartments. So it's now known that, you know, Russian intelligence bombed their own people and try to make it look like it was Chechnyans to sort of make Putin look like he was, you know, fighting the terrorists who are a big threat. And then also, you know, he did other things. He implemented these pronatal policies to encourage childbearing. He cracked down on alcoholism and drug abuse, which was a huge problem in Russian society. He oversaw really a return to stability after the chaos of the 1990s in Russia. And so for that reason, Putin has a lot of popularity in Russia because he really did return stability. He gave Russia some real wins, some real victories, particularly in Chechnya. And then in 2008, Georgia had what's called the Rose Revolution, where they also had some pro-Russian guys who were kind of kicked out. They got a more pro-democratic, pro-Western guy. The pro-Western guy also wanted to resolve some territorial disputes. He successfully resolved one territorial dispute in a region called Adjaria. And then there was a region called South Ossetia that Georgia wanted to bring back into the fold, but they didn't quite have a plan for how to do it. Russia and the South Ossetians started bombing Georgia, shooting across the border, shelling across the border. And then Russia clandestinely moved troops in. staged an attack on a Georgian border post and then invaded Georgia as a preemptive strike to prevent Georgia from seizing South Ossetia. So in this war in 2008, Russia basically slapped down the upstart Georgians, marched in, took a bunch of their land, forced them to kind of have no shot at retaking South Ossetia. And again, this, you know, Putin looked really strong. He accomplished these things. Then, you know, he hosted the Olympics. He kept doing all this stuff that really was like delivering a lot of pride for Russians. You know, Russia's a strong horse, so to speak. But then, of course, there was, you know, involvement in Syria, all these things. But over time, what's happened is Russia's gotten more and more assertive. Russia has gotten more confident in itself, recovered from the disorder of the 1990s, more of the belief that they can really flex their muscles on the world stage, that they're not going to put up with the West bullying them or disregarding their interests. And also Putin secured his power and has become more concerned that the West, particularly after both the Iraq war and the intervention in Libya, Putin has very obviously grown more concerned that the West might try to intervene to like overthrow him or something, which is fairly preposterous. The idea that we would like invade Russia is preposterous. I mean, we've clearly learned from Napoleon, don't invade Russia. but it's what he's afraid of. So that's what was going on in Russia, was this strong man becoming popular and restoring a sense of like pride and dignity and the power of the nation. And so Ukraine is really where kind of the rubber has met the road on that. And it turns out it's not going so well for Russia.
So when you hear speculation here in the United States about, well, if we keep this up long enough and kind of prolong this stalemate, the Russian people are going to rise up and overthrow Putin, what's your reaction?
I would be skeptical. I doubt the Russian people would rise up. It's possible that Russian elites in the wealthy business class and the military might decide to knock off Putin, but I doubt the Russian people would. No, I don't think that's very plausible. And particularly, whoever replaces Putin might not be, you know, he might not be a liberal Democrat, so to speak. Like, it might not be some pro-America guy. It could be someone who's even more belligerent. So, I'm skeptical of this whole if we just had a slightly different person in power in Russia, then this would be solved. No, I mean, the reason Russia and Ukraine are in conflict is because of deep, long-lasting differences of interests and power that make conflict likely. The exact timing and structure of it might relate to who's in power, but I mean, these were two trains on a collision course.
How has the Russian invasion already begun to rewrite Ukraine's demographics?
4 million people have fled Ukraine, mostly women and children. Thousands or tens of thousands, I mean, tens of thousands at this point, maybe hundreds of that, maybe more than 100,000 of people have died. The net result of this is intensified population decline for Ukraine. One of the unfortunate realities is that Ukraine could win the war and yet lose the long-term conflict of strategy, because they may lose so much population over the course of this war that they are in an even more jeopardized position for the next war. And again, if Ukraine wins, it doesn't change the reality of the strategic interests on both sides. It's likely that there would be another war. And I think that's something that has to be kept in mind, that whatever peace settlement occurs, it has to ensure that Ukraine has the means to defend itself and provide even more of a deterrent than they had before this. Until Ukraine can right its demographic balance and stop the hemorrhaging of people to migration and bring about more positive fertility rates, their relative position with regard to Russia will continue to erode, making them a juicier and juicier target. So until the demographic situation changes, the risk of war will continue to remain high.
Will the war have an effect on Russia's demographics?
Obviously, it hasn't caused the same level of like destruction and displacement in Russia, but it's possible that economic dislocations from the war could influence fertility. That, and you know, I mean, the economic dislocations and uncertainty resulting from the war could impact fertility in Russia. It could impact mortality. It could impact migration. A lot of people have moved away. A lot of people have fled Russia in the last month. There's been really high outflows from Russia. So it'll probably have a negative effect on Russia's demography as well, though not as negative.
Then with about a minute here, Lyman, what other effects should we expect to follow the war in Ukraine?
I mean, a massively increased Ukrainian diaspora around the world is going to have important political effects. Ukraine's not going to go away as an issue. We're going to have more Ukrainian neighbors, and they're going to have opinions about this, and they're going to be loud about it. So the idea that, oh, this is an issue, you know, this will be a few more media cycles and then it will blow over. No, it's not going to. Ukraine is going to be with us for a long time, this issue is. And so I think it's important for countries like the U.S. to think rationally about how to respond to this kind of issue, to decide what degree of commitment we can sustain for what's likely to be a decades-long contest of strategy and power. Maybe not always a hot war, but definitely a strategic competition.
Lyman Stone is a PhD candidate in population dynamics at McGill University. He's director of research for demographic intelligence, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, research fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, and author of a recent study titled The Demography of War, Ukraine versus Russia. You can read it at issuesztc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Lyman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
After the break, we're going to discuss a verdict in the trial of Finnish Lutheran leaders for statements on human sexuality. Lorcan Price of Alliance Defending Freedom International will be our guest.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we cruise further along in 2 Corinthians with commendation of Titus, collection for the saints, a cheerful giver, thanks be to God, and our spiritual warfare. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand. Listen at thewordendures.org or your favorite podcast provider.
For nearly 140 years, the Lutheran Witness has taught the faith, defended it against error, and shown forth the great treasures of the Lutheran Church and biblical doctrine. We're continuing this legacy by publishing issues and articles that help you see the world from a Lutheran perspective and that teach biblical doctrine and show forth the treasures of God's Word. Visit our website to learn more and how to subscribe, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
We desire for all Christian children, including those with learning or behavior challenges, to receive a strong education in the faith. At simplyclassical.com, you will find reading, penmanship, and copybook exercises based on the truth, wisdom, and comfort of God's Word. We include Aesop's fables and classic children's literature, math and science, all from Memoria Press. Use promo code LPR22 at simplyclassical.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries, right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.